Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism, the show about how anarchism, non-domination, cooperation, mutual aid is part of your everyday life. I am your host, Graham Culbertson, and today's episode is a sequel. It is called Divorcing Anarchism and Liberalism. I spoke with the author, Alexander Lefebvre, about his book, Liberalism as a Way of Life, and we intended to find places where liberalism and anarchism agreed and disagreed, but we agreed so much that at the end, Alex said, let's get married. So that one aired earlier as marrying anarchism and liberalism, and in this one, we're trying to get divorced. We still end up agreeing a lot. I think probably too much. Maybe we were just too agreeable, but we did find some points of disagreement, and also we talk a decent amount about the economics of basketball. And if you care about basketball, I think that will really help this make sense. If you don't care about basketball, maybe this isn't the episode for you. I do understand. We can all agree that Duke sucks. And now on to the episode.
Thanks, Graham, for having me back on. Glad to our honeymoon phase is over, and let's get to it.
Okay, so we ended, you know, with me complaining about doctors as I frequently do, but maybe we didn't really get to this concept of liberaldom. So let me put forth a claim. A version of this claim is made by Kropotkin. So it's a good claim from the anarchist tradition, which goes something like this, which is liberals claim that they like freedom and justice and fairness and cooperation, like everyone else on the left claims that they like. But, you know, less the social contract and more just the idea of contracts and property, the idea that people owning things and institutions, usually state institutions, protecting the ownership of these things is going to create what you call liberaldom. It's eventually going to create huge assemblages of power and capitalism and a bad version of the meritocracy. So if your idea, if I understand it correctly, is that liberalism wants to live in a world of pure liberalism, but is stuck with these bad things that are incompatible with liberalism, like capitalism and the bad kind of meritocracy. Kropotkin's claim, and I think I mostly agree with this, is that the attempt to formulate rules and laws and structures that make liberalism work in this sort of dialectical way are what creates liberaldom. And so liberals are always saying, oh no, we want liberalism, but we ended up with liberaldom. And Kropotkin, and he says this in a speech he's giving to a group of liberals, says, yeah, of course.
Right.
You made it. Liberalism always makes liberaldom. And the liberals always say, what's wrong? Why do we have so much capitalism here? So let's start there and respond however you'd like.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so this would mark a divergence. So that's good. That's what we wanted. So the idea of, just to refresh listeners and perhaps myself as well. So the idea of liberaldom is a key idea in my book. And what I'm doing there is I'm riffing on Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard, 19th century Danish theologian, looked around his world and he looked at everyone professing a belief in Christianity, loving the good life of Christ. But when he really looked at these same people, he found that they didn't live up to a Christian morality at all. They weren't bad people exactly, but they were just like liberals. They were kind of bourgeois Philistines. Like they just wanted like kind of like good manners, social respectability, a bit of property, nice dinners, that kind of thing. And there could be worse things, but that is certainly an anti-Christian thing. And so Kierkegaard came up with this idea called Christendom, which is the world that results from people play-acting at their Christianity, from giving it notional lip service, but not committing to it. Now, the adaptation I do in my book is really a sort of paint by the numbers. And I say, look, I don't think we live in Christendom anymore. Christianity is not a publicly professed religion. It doesn't have state power, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we have its analog, which is called liberaldom. So here's the split that you and I would have here. My sense is that liberaldom comes as a result of failing to try or even to want to try to live up to the demands of liberalism, primarily that of trying to be trying to strive for fairness, trying to be just a more generous person in general, whether that's with your wallet or with your mind or with your time and attention. And what you're saying, so I'm saying that liberaldom is what we get when we pretend at our liberal values but don't really live up to them. What you're saying, by contrast, is liberaldom is what we get when we actually follow through with our liberal values. So I think that that would be a meaningful split. I would be hard-pressed to understand, though, how it is that the liberal values them. It depends what value. Look, it depends. One of the this is so I'm going to sound like I'm going to duck, but one of the great liberal thinkers of our time, I had lunch with him. It's Michael Friedan from Oxford University. He wrote the short introduction from Oxford, very short introductions on liberalism. And he's written a bunch of books. Great thinker. And he said, look, Alex, liberalism is basically, the history of liberalism is just so all over the shop. And when I think about liberalism, I think about modular furniture. And what he meant by that is that you can move the bits and ideas of liberalism around as if you're decorating a room. And there are so many different ideas of liberalism that you can make different ideas of it the star. So if you're a huge property rights kind of person or market kind of person, like a neoliberal, you can park that bit of furniture, say that's the couch, I don't know, in the middle of the room, and everything takes on that orbit. Or if you're more of a social democrat kind of person and you want to go for kind of fair taxation stuff, then you put the dining table in the center of the room, and then everything else sort of reorients its gravity around that. So what I would, so coming back to the point, is if you want to put one of those concepts that I don't love so much about liberalism at the center of the room, and it definitely has a trajectory. Liberalism is such a plural tradition, you can find it. So if you want to put like market freedoms and kind of like hardcore individual autonomy at the heart of your liberal tradition, then I think Popkin's claim is plausible, that if you live up to those values, then you're going to get sort of a world like us. But if you put fairness or some other liberal intuition that I much more favor at the center of the room, then I don't see how that criticism gains traction.
So, first of all, you're right on that when Kropotkin is making this point, and I don't remember the details. If anyone wants to find the episode, Ian MacKay and I discussed this in my episode with Ian MacKay on Kropotkin. I'll try and put a link to that in the show notes. He's talking to liberals, you know, in the sense of what is now called classical liberalism, as you mentioned in your book. He's talking to propertarian liberals. But I can do this with fairness as well. And I'm going to do, and I don't know if this drives people crazy or not. I don't get enough granular feedback, but I'm going to do this with a sports metaphor. And it's actually one that I've been using all the way back to my dissertation. So there's this thing called football. And in America, the system is totally capitalist socialism. So all of the teams share, and there's a lot of variance in who wins, because if you do really well, you lose your best players and you lose the ability to pay them, and money goes to other players. So it's a very socialist thing, although you have to be a capitalist, you have to be a billionaire to buy into it. Right. By contrast, football in England, the Premier League is pretty much just purely...
It's money.
Yeah, capitalist. But so you can spend as much as you want, and it used to be that the big teams always won. But then the oil money started coming in, and now usually, although Liverpool keeps breaking this rule, the team with the most oil money wins. Now, by contrast, the fairest football league by far, the fairest major football league, is the Bundesliga. I happen to be wearing a Bundesliga jersey right now. Actually. But, and so the competition is fair every time. Every season, it's fair, and there's revenue sharing, and the fans are involved. It's very special. But Bayern wins pretty much every year, because winning begets winning, and they use their winning to attract more fans and attract more money and sell more merch, which they turn into winning. And so actually... some fans in the Bundesliga, it's beautiful that you can't, as a Petro state, buy into the Bundesliga. But some fans of the Bundesliga complain about this. And they're like, we need a Petro state to come in and make this fair system more unfair so it can be more fair, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay.
So when you start with fairness, or rather, when you start with a level playing field, as liberals love to start with, but you let the winners keep their winnings and spend it on winning, liberalism is going to create oligarchy every time, unless you pair it with a really rigorous form of socialism.
Yes, I agree. So, okay, all right, this isn't okay. So if... But you're an anarchist, so like I feel like I'm having the table shifted on me. So if you want to say whether liberalism inclines towards socialism at the end of the day, or some democratic socialism, something like that, I would agree with that, and that's what the case I've tried to make in my book. And so, and it's not like I'm Dora the Explorer here. There's so many of the great liberals of the liberal tradition are kind of like crypto, like if it's Scooby Doo and you pull the mask off, they're kind of crypto socialists. So Mill is kind of OG J.S. Mill. In this respect, but ditto Rawls. I mean, there's a great book that came out a few years ago on Rawls with the title John Rawls, Reticent Socialist. And the idea is that as he got older, he started to think that of his alternatives of property-owning democracy and democratic socialism, property-owning democracy wasn't going to live up to the demands of justice as fairness. And so more and more we had to move towards a particular regulation of the basic structure, the major institutions that would approximate democratic socialist. So if we're talking about that, then I think we are in heated agreement, and that's good.
No. I mean, I'm going to try and disagree then, so we can stop being in heated agreement, because the only way to do this, the only way to make democratic socialism work, right, unless you're going to do it in some totally anarchic way in which people are voluntarily solidaristic, is to take money away from people and give it to other people and really make the system in some deep fundamental way unfair. And that's why, go ahead.
Are you not just describing progressive taxation? That seems like what progressive taxation is meant to do. Like, look, to take my, to go on your sports terrain here, the NBA is sort of like the NFL in this respect, in that there's a salary cap for each team so that the Knicks, for example, can't absolutely dominate payroll-wise over the Milwaukee Bucks, for example. And the lowest team, it's a lottery system where the lowest team in the league gets the highest percentage chance for the first round draft pick. So that's kind of what, I mean, I get your point that you have to be a billionaire to buy an NBA team. That's not the point. But the idea is that would be sort of like a liberal democratic redistribution scheme, or kind of attempting to keep the basic structure as fair as possible. And winners and losers are going to arise in that. But we're trying to give them the same opportunity to do so. And I know these sounds like platitudes. And so often the rule is broken. So for example, I don't know if you follow this, there's a scandal right now in the NBA because the Dallas Mavericks just got the first pick for the next year draft. And they had a 1% chance going in of getting, it should have been the Charlotte Hornets or the Washington Wizards, because they truly, well and truly suck. But the Dallas Mavericks got the first pick. They're going to get this phenom Cooper Flagg. And there's all these accusations of rigged because they think that the NBA specifically favored that team and wanted to build a kind of, they have a great team already, they want to build it up. And so that would be an example of liberaldom, of the NBA just putting its hand on the scales and saying, forget this, we're going to try to favor the already advantaged because that will give us more attention, more revenue, et cetera. But the end, so that would be a deviation. So that's the kind of thing that I would be talking about liberaldom. But the actual NBA salary cap and lottery pick system, that for me would be, I don't know what I'm committing to here, but a fair metaphor for liberalism in the way I want it.
Yeah. Liberalism in the way you want it. I'm skeptical that you can get something like giving, constantly giving the worst team the best player, who, by the way, does not have the option to just go to whatever team he wants to play on, because there's a collective bargaining agreement, a union that he is not a part of, which has bargained away his rights to go to the team he wants to, because a giant corporation has decided the giant corporation known as the NBA has decided it's better to run this system in a pretty quasi-socialist way, not because they value fairness, but, you know, because they value money, and they think that competition creates fairness. So I'm not inclined to take. I mean, I know. Maybe we can bring this back to Rawls.
Let's do it.
So then, Rawls's. If we're thinking about this in terms of something like the original position or the veil of ignorance, like if you were the fan of an NBA team, God, I went down this sports road and here we are.
I watch NFL too. So you want to do NFL? Yeah. You do NFL?
No. I don't watch the NFL anymore. But it's just so rigidly corporate socialist. It's such a good example.
Yeah, it is.
If you're Rawls, I think the idea that the best player, the best new player, goes to the worst team feels pretty fair.
It's the difference principle. The most talented should help the least advantage. I mean, that's not a wrong interpretation. So Cooper Flagg should go help the hapless Charlotte Hornets. He's the aristocrat in this business and bringing his generous talents and time to this poor, struggling village.
But it seems to me that the liberal position would be that Cooper Flagg should get to play for the team that he wants to play for. Why are we restricting Cooper Flagg in this way?
Because this is where it becomes unfair of me in the sense, because I think you're going back to the Kropotkin criticism of liberalism, and I really don't think it's a straw man. I don't think he's flattening a version of liberalism. I think there is very much that robust sense of individual empowering the individual agent to make their own decisions, and in that sense, that would be consistent with the whole trajectory of liberalism. And I should add, moreover, I don't know if we talked about this last week, that proponents of that vision of liberalism think that they're doing that not because they're out for kind of money or profit or greed, but because they think that individual choice is the surest way to freedom, because what could better allocate value in our society than the market? It's not some freaking state agency in Moscow or in Washington that's going to do that rationally. This is the Hayek. It's all these micro decisions being made all the time, and that's going to lead to fair outcomes. So I don't want to say that these kind of market-driven liberals are just like in it for the money. That's not it. But I think your take on the kind of Cooper Flagg should be able to sell his wares wherever he likes, that's a very liberal position, but it's not the one I try to defend or bring up as, and it's not one I don't think committed to fairness in the sense that Rawls uses that term, maybe other senses of fairness, as I just mentioned. And look, it would be like, how to put this? This is why I think so you want to talk about the original position in Rawls, and I'm happy to kind of pivot away to use a sports metaphor away from the sports in general and say a word about this original position, because it's such an interesting idea. And so the original position is just to set this up, this is Rawls's best known idea. And people often criticize, a lot of people made careers out of this. Hello, Michael Sandel, about trying to interpret the word, the original position in the most kind of like ungenerous way possible. And this ungenerous interpretation is that the original position requires you to bracket all knowledge that you have of yourself. So you don't know your gender, your sex, your talents, your conception of the good life, et cetera, et cetera. And then from there, you try to make the most rational decision as to the kind of social order you want to live in. And the idea is that most people will be prudent in that situation. Because if you don't know who you are or what kind of society that you live in, you're going to make some very cautious decisions as to how that society should be structured, because you don't want to be at the terrible short end of the stick. For example, you say that that Christians should be in charge of the country, and then you discover, oh no, I'm a Muslim, when you have knowledge of yourself, because then you're just stuck in an order you don't want to live in. So from a certain conception of liberalism, the original position models this idea of like individual market instrumental rationality, where under certain constraints, you're just trying to min-max all the time. You're just trying to find the most rational course of action. And that's one interpretation. I just think it's a bad interpretation of what the original position is trying to do. The original position is trying to get people into the headspace of be willing to bracket their positional advantage. And for a lot of people, that is a positively irrational thing to do in the sense of trying to achieve top outcomes. So I'm a white guy, I'm heterosexual, I'm middle class, like I tick all the hegemonic boxes on like the kind of like that census category. And if you were to ask me to suspend my knowledge of those things, a certain part of me wants to say, fuck off. Those things are really helping me and are allowing me to thrive in this world. I'm getting all kinds of advantages from those endowments or those qualities or whatever you want to call them. And what Rawls is asking you to do is like, look in your heart, that's not fair, and agree to suspend those qualities. And so that would be the Cooper flag kind of thing. It's right. Hey, Coop, you don't want to just go join the, I don't know, Oklahoma City Thunder, the best team right now in the league, because you recognize deep down that that's not cool. You should rather try to bracket who you are and act accordingly. And I think that that's just a very different approach to decision than is typically associated with liberalism, but it has a rich tradition of trying to be an impartial, generous, free person.
I mean, I think unfortunately we're going to agree again on this. I mean, I want to say briefly, the way I think of the original position is that I take it as a rewriting of Kant's categorical imperative that tries to bring the categorical imperative into history or into society in a way the categorical imperative doesn't. So it asks you to do the exact same work that the categorical imperative does, which is like, I want to live in a society. The categorical imperative, briefly for listeners, if you don't know it, and it's formulated in a bunch of different ways, and Kant is even more infuriating than Rawls. But basically, one of the ways to put the categorical imperative is that everyone counts equally. But maybe a more useful way is like, all rules that you would, all actions that you take, you would want to exist, you would want a rule to be generated that rule could apply to everyone. And then the problem is like, you could very easily be like, oh man, I, as an American, think that America should have hegemony over the entire American continent, North and South. Let's see, am I okay with everyone following that rule? Yes, I am okay with people in Russia following the rule that America has hegemony over the Americas. And so Rawls looks at this very abstract rule and says, this actually works, but instead of trying to do it this at this abstract level, let's pretend you don't know if you're America or Russia, and all of a sudden, or indeed if you might be Argentinian, and all of a sudden you may not want to sign up for this rule. The United States gets to tell Argentina and Panama and Chile what to do. So does that sound good as a way to think about
it? I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's a good reinterpretation of what Rawls is trying to do and within his history. And I'm not trying to make, let me be more concessive here. I'm not trying to make liberalism the best thing in the world, though I do think it's a pretty good thing. And I think that the criticism, I'm really trying to be a bit, I'm being a bit cute here, saying that, oh, I'm not talking about that bad version of liberalism that depends on individualism. I'm talking about this good version of liberalism that talks about solidarity. And What I think is actually more accurate is while I'm talking about that more good version of solidarity, I do think that the liberal is always constantly tempted by individualism because that is so baked into their doctrine. So it's a deep belief of mine that every great religion or moral system has characteristic ways of being good, but also characteristic ways of deviating from that good. And it's going to give different kinds of shitty people. So for example, I think the characteristic shitty Christian, for example, is someone who is, rather than kind of open loving, is very judgy and kind of like surveillance kind of thing. And I think that's internal to the doctrine because there's so much pressure on salvation and of inner scrutiny. And it's natural kind of for Christians to push that outwards and defect from it. For liberals, I don't think liberals are judgy. I mean, sometimes they are, but I don't think that's their major vice. I think rather it's kind of like shitty egoism in that they're constantly being told that they matter, that they should be free to live their lives on their own account. And it's so easy for people to stop wanting to be kind of morally ambitious and instead just go and make bank, do what's best for them and their friends and their family. And so I guess I think that's right. I think liberalism has this constant siren call or temptation towards individualism, and that's not accidental at all. It'd be interesting to know, though, because you know my tradition much less than I know your tradition. What is the way the anarchist is bad in this way? What's the siren of the anarchist?
Okay, I'm going to answer that question, but I actually as you were talking, I realized that there's a little more work to be done with basketball. And I'm sorry if you're listening to this podcast right now and you're just like, I don't know who Cooper Flagg is. So I just want to point out that the scenario that I laid out, that Cooper Flagg doesn't have to, he's not bound to play for the team that he has been allocated to, but he gets to play for whatever team has the most money, wealth, and power and maximizes his star power. Actually, we do have that for 1 year. It's called NCAA basketball, and Cooper Flagg went to the richest, wealthiest, most liberal dumb university in the world, Duke University, and just like totally he is a great illustration of the way that if you emphasize freedom of choice and make a system that's, I mean, it's fair, right? Every single university got to call Cooper Flagg and tell him, hey, you should come play basketball here. And also we will give you this much money because it briefly, you know, universities used to pretend they weren't paying players bags of money for them to come back to play basketball. For the past couple of years, they've been allowed to pay them. And Cooper Flagg, good liberal that he is, at least in this bad sort of liberal, went to the play, you know, I mean, and you can just from the original position, right? Sure. If someone was called, and I don't know who I am, you know, but do I think the best basketball player should be able to go play for the best basketball teams? This seems pretty good if you're not being socialist in your reasoning. And in other words, Cooper Flagg was an actual example of the bad individualist version of liberalism in terms of...
Not to flog the flag, but we're not talking about Cooper Flagg. We're talking about systems. And we're talking... Yeah. We're comparing, I think, pretty aptly, the constraints that the NBA imposes and the non-constraints that the NCAA is just kind of like, let it rip. And that's what's significant here. So the figure of Cooper Flagg is just neither here nor there. It's what these different systems enable him or disable him to do. And in this sense, my vision of liberalism, I think, is more approximate, God help me, to the NBA rather than to the NCAA, which is bullshit on so many levels.
Right. Except, God, I was going to answer the question, what makes anarchists bad? And I still can. But except the NCAA didn't allow players to be free agents like this until there are good liberal courts of law in the United States looked at all of the totally unfair and oligarchic strictures that colleges were putting on players, paying Rick Pitino who knows how many tens of millions of dollars, and the Cooper Flags nothing, asterisk. They were getting paid, but they were also getting investigated by the FBI for getting paid. And so the fact that this is the Kropotkin argument, that every time you look at one of these systems that attempts to create fairness, and that was the goal of the NCAA, was to create this fair and indeed even like noble system, and the liberal judgedom of the United States of America looked at that and was like, individuals are being oppressed and they should be able to have lots more millions of dollars than this organization is allowing them to have.
No, that's right. Well, do you think that's morally, I know you think that's morally wrong, but like, the NCAA is just such a pathological case, because if the student athletes aren't getting paid, it just pours back into the university and makes, cry me a tear for like Florida State coaches. Like, they're making more money than the presidents of those universities. So it's just a very pathological system, which I guess is liberaldom in action. And you have just, yeah, no, I think it's interesting. I think there's a paper there. Maybe we could co-author that one day. I don't know.
I mean, but again, my argument is, when you try and apply like as purely liberal fixes as you can, you're going to keep getting these concatenations of power that are absolutely antithetical to the ideals of liberalism, and yet seem to have sprung out of the ideals of liberalism. And you gotta just put your foot down and say, I believe in liberty, I believe in freedom, but I see an awful warping of the system. I see it. I know it's what it is. And we can't use liberalism to get us out of this mess, because that's how we get Duke somehow being able to spend even more money on student athletes.
That's it. No, listen. Okay. Right. Let's put this one to bed and say that we see each other.
Okay. Now, in terms of the question of what makes a bad anarchist, or what kind of, what are the flaws that anarchy naturally flows to? I mean, my first professional instinct is to say, well, it depends on what kind of anarchist you're talking about, and talk about the different traditions. But I'm not going to do that. Here's the problem, as far as I can see, or the obvious problem with anarchic groups. So I've been doing a lot of Tolkien. I've been reading him, about to be teaching him. I brought a Tolkien quote, actually, for our discussion, but it hasn't been relevant yet. But there is a quote in The Lord of the Rings, when the Fellowship is setting out, where they're talking about, you know, whether they need to swear an oath to stay true to the Fellowship. And Gimli the dwarf says, a strong word may strengthen quaking heart. And Gandalf, the very wise anarchic wizard, says, or break it. So the idea is, when you've got people in an organization and they're dedicated to a project and they want to do something, and they want to do something good in the world, it does seem, in this world that we live in, that the more purely anarchic organizations that set out to do this, as opposed to a more contractual 501(c)(3) or whatever the nonprofit terminology is here in the United States, the ones that bind people, you have a job, you are doing this, those do seem to do a better job than the anarchic ones. Those anarchist organizations tend to splinter and fracture and just sort of disappear. And the work that they set out to do, there's just an argument one day at the meeting and the group doesn't exist anymore. And then this is the different kinds of anarchists. The other problem is when you get one of those groups that's basically being run tyrannically, you know, there's a charismatic leader, and this charismatic leader does not have a title, you know, is not the boss of anyone. All decisions are made in terms of consensus, but gradually the people who oppose that person just sort of fade away, and the institution becomes a little petty monarchy despite no formal structures. So those are my two guesses of what can go wrong with the anarchists. They can disappear, right, or because they don't have a constitution, they don't have a plan for how to deal with power, because they just think like, oh, in a consensus system, we don't have a problem with power. And then power can get really corrupting in that way.
But okay, that's fine. But that's not exactly the question I asked. So let me press again. So the question I wasn't asked is, why are anarchist groups unstable? Or how can they break bad? Which is a fine question. It's just not the one I was asking. I was saying, how are anarchists, what's the distinct human shittiness towards which anarchists tend? And I think it's important to be distinct. I think it's a very interesting, maybe this is my, so Judith Sklar wrote this book that I absolutely love called Ordinary Vices. And what she tries to do is she tries to distinguish different personality types according to which vice they think is the worst thing in the world. And you get totally different thinkers and trajectories and institutions depending on that. So if you put hypocrisy first, you get a kind of Nietzsche person. If you put cruelty first, you get a kind of Montaigne or Montesquieu person. It's a really interesting thought experiment. And so my sense is that the liberal bad person is going to be the egoist. The Christian bad person is going to be the judge in a nasty way. The bad Confucian person, for example, is going to be someone who's super hierarchical and domineering. I guess my question then is, what is the bad anarchist? And so, it would be interesting if it's also something like selfishness or egoism, which would show that liberalism and anarchy have the same pathological problem, which would be an interesting kind of trajectory to develop.
Yeah. So I guess I take your point that I didn't answer the question. My initial response, though, and I would have to think about it a little bit more, but is the same as the, except, you know, so one is a sort of dilettantishness, right? So the anarchist, the bad anarchist is always, you know, starting projects, but then feeling like, oh, that's just not like my bag anymore, man. And in fact, I heard about a different, you know, community project that I got really involved in. But, And this may or may not tie into that second scenario. The thing I have encountered, not in real life, but on the internet, and you encounter this a lot on the internet, is because anarchism has a real tendency to go all the way, to go as far as it can go. Right. So like an obvious example is like the fruitarians, like people who literally or freegans will not eat anything, you know, that like involve the loss of life of even a plant, because, you know, it seems like if anarchy is about life and love and freedom and organic growth, then like, you know, scything wheat seems like a real oppression. And so when I started calling myself an anarchist and started this podcast and everything, in part I did so because I was so tired of progressive scolding about everything. And the
From within the anarchist camp.
No, I was tired of progressive scolding from within the progressive camp. Yeah, I was in. Right. I was just so sick of everyone being scolded about everything. You know, you can't watch Dave Chappelle, and I'm not a fan of Dave Chappelle, and I did not watch Dave Chappelle before or after he was canceled, but that sort of thing. And then I found a rich tradition in anarchy of people acknowledging that everything is messy and we're not all going to be freegans and we have to work together. But I also found a lot of people, and this may reflect some of anarchy's roots in Christianity as well, who were just like, you know, if you are an anarchist, you've signed up for these 72 principles and you can't call yourself an anarchist unless you haven't signed up for these principles. And I was like, well, I thought like anarchism meant that like we don't even know what the principles are and we're working it out together. And it was like, no, you're obviously spoken like someone who is not an anarchist.
Yeah. Okay. That's very, okay. That's great. So, kind of intemperate zeal. That's a kind of thing that the anarchist is tempted towards. So in my book, I develop all these spiritual exercises for liberals to counteract their tendencies to be egoist and to press their advantage, et cetera. What would be the spiritual exercise that would be suitable for anarchists to get their head in the right game?
So going to keep agreeing. I mean, I do think the original position wouldn't be a bad one, but it seems obvious that the one that anarchists need to do, right, is simply go out and cooperate with people. I mean, that's the everyday part of anarchism that I am interested in. So in other words, to me, it's pretty anarchist if you arrange a carpool in your neighborhood. And that carpool should be arranged with the people who are trying to get to the same place you are trying to get and trying to cut down on emissions. You shouldn't start by announcing that you are an anarchist and you are looking for like-minded people to join an anarchist collective that goes to the grocery store. You should just do anarchy, which is to say, cooperate in solidaristic, non-hierarchical ways. And that would, is that a spiritual practice? I don't
yeah,
know, but
sure
I think in some ways, I think it is as well. I think that's a spiritual practice. And anarchists maybe don't even need to spend very little time with other quote anarchists. And I should say here, I'm drawing deeply from the work of Ruth Kenna, who is a dear friend and has been on this podcast a bunch of times. And she says, you know, the goal of anarchism, at least as she defines it, is not to create an anarchist society, but to bring anarchist practices to all of the institutions that already exist.
I can listen. We went through a rough patch, but we can fully agree on that one. No, that's all right. That's all right.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a great principle. I mean, I don't think liberals aren't like that. Liberals are more kind of my way or the highway, and I don't think we're just trying to infuse a bit of our sensibility here and there. It's much more systemic, structural, prescriptive, whatever. So that's a very, that is, so I guess that's a disagreement. I mean, not a disagreement, but just a very different approach.
Yeah. And I should say that, again, I'm speaking from a member of the everyday anarchist tradition, which is a long and powerful one and goes right through Kropotkin without a doubt. But Kropotkin was also a revolutionary, and he strongly advocated for everyday anarchism and found it in the principles of the dinner table. Good. And he also said capitalism and the state should be destroyed, you know, by violence if necessary.
Okay. Right.
And you know, I'm not saying that. And that is the other, I mean, that again, this is maybe the same version of the ultra judgmental anarchists, and this is again where I sort of started this podcast, is like, if anarchist calls to mind someone in a black mask breaking things, then that's not what I'm interested in. But I do admit that those people are anarchists and are drawing on the same tradition from I am. That seems to me pretty similar with, if someone thinks liberalism is the best and the brightest get the most money, that's not what you mean by liberalism, but that is an accessible part of the liberal tradition.
Yeah. No, we both have a brand crisis. That's right.
Yeah.
I'd like spoken like a true liberal.
Yeah. Yeah. A brand crisis. So I don't know. We'll we'll continue mostly agreeing and sort of disagreeing. Thank you for your time, Alex.
It's been an absolute pleasure. This is good. We'll come back and this will be like a 7-Up series. I'll come back in 7 years.
We'll see if this podcast's still around in 7 years. All right. Bye now.
Right. Thanks.